The king suddenly looked surprised or shocked. He had been sitting relaxed between them because he was tired and unhappy, yet now he drew himself up and met his captain in the eye. "You must remember, I am the King of England. When you are a king, you can't go executing people as the fancy takes you. A king is the head of his people, and he must stand as an example to them, and do as they wish." He forgave the startled expression in Lancelot's face and took his hand once more. "You will find," he explained, "that when the kings are bullies who believe in force, the people are bullies too. If I don't stand for law, I won't have law among my people. And naturally, I want my people to have the new law, because then they are more prosperous, and I am more prosperous in consequence." They watched him, wondering what he meant to convey. He held the look, trying to speak with their eyes. "You see, Lance, I have to be absolutely just. I can't afford to have any more things like those babies on my conscience. The only way I can keep clear of force is by justice. Far from being willing to execute his enemies, a real king must be willing to execute his friends."
"And his wife?" asked Guinevere.
"And his wife," he said gravely. Lancelot moved uncomfortably on the settle, remarking with an attempt at humour, "I hope you won't be cutting off the Queen's head very soon." The King still held his hand, still looked upon him. "If Guinevere, or you, Lancelot, were proved to be guilty of a wrong to my kingdom, I should have to cut off both your heads."
"Goodness me!" she exclaimed. "I hope nobody is going to prove that."
"I hope so too."
"And Mordred?" asked Lancelot after a time.
"Mordred is an unhappy young man, and I am afraid he might try any means of giving me an upset. If, for instance, he could see a way of getting at me through you, dear, or through Gwen, I'm sure he would try it. Do you see what I mean?"
"I see."
"So, if there should ever come a moment when either of you might give him a sort of handle, you will be careful of me, won't you? I am in your hands, dears."
"But it seems so senseless."
"You have been kind to him," said Lancelot, "since he came here. Why should he want to harm?"
The king folded his hands in his lap, seemed under his lowered lids to be looking on the flames.
"You forget," he said gently, "that I never managed to give Gwen a son. When I am dead, Mordred may be the King of England." "If he tries any treason," said Lancelot, clenching his fists, "I will kill him myself."
Immediately the blue-veined hand was on his arm.
"That is the one thing you must never do, Lance. Whatever Mordred does, and even if he makes an attempt on my life, you must promise to remember that he is a sort of heir apparent to the blood. I have been a wicked man."
"Arthur!" exclaimed the Queen. "You are not to say so. It is so ridiculous that it makes me feel ashamed."
"You would not call me a wicked man?" he asked in surprise.
"Of course not."
"But I should have thought, after the story of these babies..."
"Nobody," cried Lancelot fiercely, "would dream of such a thought."
The king stood up in the firelight, looking puzzled and pleased. He considered it ridiculous to suppose that he was not wicked, but he was grateful for their love.
Well, he said, in any case, I don't propose to be wicked any longer. It is a king's business to prevent bloodshed if he can, not to provoke it.
He looked at them once more under his eyebrows.
So now, my dears, he ended cheerfully, I shall run along to the Court of Pleas and arrange some of our famous justice. You stay here with Gwen, Lance, and cheer her up after that wretched story. There's a good fellow.
Chapter 5. When Arthur had said that he was going to arrange some of his famous justice, he did not mean that he was actually going to sit. Kings did sit, personally, in the Middle Ages, even as late as the so-called Henry IV, who was supposed to have sat both in the Exchequer and the King's Bench. But tonight it was too late for law-giving. Arthur was off to read the pleas for the morrow, a practice which he followed like a conscientious man. Nowadays the law was his chief interest, his final effort against might. In Uther Pendragon's time there had been no law to speak of, except a childish and one-sided kind of etiquette which was reserved for the upper classes. Even now, since the king had begun to encourage justice so as to bind the power of Fort Main once for all, there were three kinds of law to be wrestled with. He was trying to boil them down, from customary, canon, and Roman law, into a single code which he hoped to call the civil one. This occupation, as well as reading the morrow's pleas, was what used to call him off to labour every evening, to solitude and silence in the justice room. The justice room was at the other end of the palace. It was not as empty as it should have been. Although there were five people in it waiting for the king, perhaps the first thing which a modern visitor would have noticed would have been the room itself. The startling thing about it was that the hangings made it square. It was night, so that the windows were covered, and the doors were never uncovered. The result was that you felt you were in a box. You had the strange feeling of symmetrical enclosure, which must be known by butterflies in killing bottles. You wondered how the five people had been introduced into the place, as if it were a Chinese puzzle. All round the walls, from floor to ceiling, in a double row, the stories of David and Bathsheba, and of Susanna and the elders, were told in flexible pictures whose gay colours were in full tone. The faded things which we see today bear no relationship to the bright tapestry which made the justice room a painted box. The five men glittered in the candlelight. There was little furniture to distract the eye from them, only a long table with the parchments laid out for the king's inspection, the king's high chair, and in the corner a raised reading desk and seat combined. The colour of the place was in the walls and men. Each of them wore a silk jupon, blazoned with the chevron and the three thistles, distinguished in the case of the younger brother with various labels of cadency, so that they looked like a hand of playing cards spread out. They were the Gawain family, and as usual, they were quarrelling. Gawain said,
"For the last time, Agravain, will you hold your gab? I winna have ert nor pert in it."
"Nor will I," said Gareth. Gaheris said, "Nor I."
"If ye press on with it, ye will but split the clan. I've told ye plain that none of us will help ye. Ye'll be left to your ain stour."
Mordred had been waiting with sneering patience. "I am on Agravain's side," he said. "Lancelot and my aunt are a disgrace to all of us. Agravain and I will take the responsibility, if no one else will." Gareth turned on him fiercely.
"Ye were aye fit for work of shame."
"Thank you." Gawain made an effort to be conciliatory. He was not a conciliatory man, so the effort looked actually physical, like an earthquake.
"Mordred," he said, "for dear sakes, hearken reason. Ye'll be a brave hind and let it bide? I'm the elder of ye, and can see what ill will come." Whatever comes of it, I am going to the king.
But Agravaine, if you do, it will mean war. Don't you see that Arthur and Lancelot will have to go for each other, and half the kings of Britain will side with Lancelot because of his reputation, and it will be a civil war?
The chieftain of the clan lumbered over to Agravaine like a good-natured animal doing a trick, and patted him with a huge paw.
Tuts, man! Forget the wee blow struck this forenoon. There is a passion in every man, and at the hinder end of it we are but brothers. I canna see how ye may bring yourself to act against Sir Lancelot, knowing what he's done for us long syne. Dinna ye mind, he rescued you, and Mordred to it, from Sir Turquin? Away, ye owe him for your lives, and so do I, man, from Sir Carados in the Dolorous Tower.
He did it for his own honour.
Gareth turned on Mordred. You can say what you like about Lancelot and Guinevere between ourselves, because unfortunately it is true, but I won't have you sneering. When I first came to court as a kitchen page, he was the only person who was decent to me. He had not the faintest idea who I was, but he used to give me tips and cheer me up, and stand up for me against Kay, and it was he who knighted me. Everybody knows that he has never done a mean thing in his life.
When I was a young knight, said Gawain, God forgive it, and fell into disputatious battle, I used to backslide into passions, aye, and kill a body after he'd yielded. And forby, I have killed a lassie. But Lancelot grieves no creature weaker than himself.
Gaheris added, he favours the young knights and tries to help them win the spurs. I can't see your grudge against him.
Mordred shrugged his shoulders, flicking his coat sleeve, and made believe to yawn.
As for Lancelot, he observed, it is Agravaine who is after him. My feud is with the Merry Monarch.
Lancelot, stated Agravaine, is above his station.
He is not, said Gareth. He is the greatest man I know.
I have no schoolboy's passion for him.
A door on the other side of the tapestry squeaked on its hinges. The handle grated.
Peace, Agravaine, urged Gawain softly. Hold off your noise.
I will not.
Arthur's hand lifted the curtain.
Please, Mordred, whispered Gareth. The king was in the room.
It is only fair, said Mordred, raising his voice so that it must be heard, that our round table should have justice after all.
Agravaine also, pretending not to have noticed anyone coming, added his loud reply.
It is time that somebody should tell the truth.
Mordred, be quiet.
And nothing but the truth, concluded the hunchback, with a sort of triumph.
Arthur, who had come pattering through the stone corridors of his palace, with a mind fixed on the work in front of him, stood waiting in the doorway without surprise. The men of the Chevron and Thistle, turning to him, saw the old king in the last minute of his glory. They stood for a few heartbeats silent, and Gareth, in a pain of recognition, saw him as he was. He did not see a hero of romance, but a plain man who had done his best. Not a leader of chivalry, but the pupil who had tried to be faithful to his curious master, the magician, by thinking all the time. Not Arthur of England, but a lonely old gentleman who had worn his crown for half a lifetime in the teeth of fate. Gareth threw himself on his knee.
It has nothing to do with us.
Gawain, lumbering to one knee more slowly, joined him on the floor.
Sir, I came been hoping to control my brothers, but they will na listen. I dinna wish to hear what they may say.
Gaheris was the last to kneel.
We want to go, before they speak.
Arthur came into the room and lifted Gawain gently.
Of course you can go, my dear, he said, if you wish it.
I hope I am not going to cause a family trouble.
Gawain turned blackly on the others.
It is a trouble,
he said, drawing the old language of knighthood round him like a cloak,
that will I destroy the flower of chivalry in all the world, a mischief to our noble fellowship, and all by cause of two unhappy knights.
When Gawain had swept contemptuously out of the room, pushing Gaheris before him, and followed by Gareth with a helpless gesture, the king walked over to the throne in silence. He took two cushions from the seat and put them on the steps.
"Well, nephews," he said evenly, "sit down and tell me what you want."
"We would rather stand."
"You can please yourselves, of course."
Such a beginning did not suit the policy of Agravaine. He protested,
"Ah, Mordred, come. Nay, we are not quarrelling with our king. There is no thought of that about it."
"I shall stand."
Agravaine sat on one of the cushions humbly.
"Would you care for two cushions?"
"No, thank you, sir."
The old man watched and waited, as a man who was to be hanged might submit to the hangman, but who would not need to help with the noose. He watched with a tired irony, leaving the work to them.
"Perhaps it would be wiser," said Agravaine
with well-made reluctance,
"to say no more about it."
"Perhaps it would." Mordred burst through the situation by main force.
"This is ridiculous! We came to tell our uncle something, and it is right he should be told."
"It is unpleasant."
"In that case, my dear boys, if you would prefer it, don't let us talk about the matter any further. These spring nights are too beautiful for us to worry with unpleasant things. So why don't the two of you go off and make it up with Gawain? You could ask him to lend you that clever goshawk of his for tomorrow. The Queen was mentioning just now how she would enjoy a nice young leveret for dinner."
He was fighting for her, perhaps for all of them. Mordred, glaring at his father with blazing eyes, announced without preamble,
"We came to tell you what every person in this court has always known. Queen Guinevere is Sir Lancelot's mistress openly."
The old man leaned down to straighten his mantle. He twitched it over his feet to keep them warm, raised himself again, and looked them in the face.
"Are you ready to prove this accusation?"
"We are."
"You know," he asked them gently, "that it has been made before."
"It would be extraordinary if it had not."
The last time that rumours of this kind were circulated, they were produced by a person called Sir Meliagrance. As the matter was not susceptible of proof in any other way, it was put to the decision of personal combat. Sir Meliagrance impeached the Queen of treason, and offered to fight for his opinion. Fortunately, Sir Lancelot was kind enough to stand for Her Majesty. You remember the result?"
"We remember well."
"When finally the combat took place, Sir Meliagrance lay flat on his back and insisted on yielding to Sir Lancelot. It was impossible to make him get up in any way until Lancelot offered to take off his helm and the left side of his armour and to have one hand tied behind his back. Sir Meliagrance accepted the offer and was duly chopped."
"We know all this," exclaimed the youngest brother impatiently. "Personal combat has no meaning. It is an unfair justice anyway. It is the thugs who win."
Arthur sighed and folded his hands. He continued in the quiet voice which he had not raised. "You are still very young, Mordred. You have yet to learn that nearly all the ways of giving justice are unfair.
if you can suggest another way of settling moot points, except by personal combat, I will be glad to try it.
Because Lancelot is stronger than others and always stands for the Queen, it does not mean that the Queen is always in the right.
I'm sure it doesn't. But then, you see, moot points have to be settled somehow once they get thrust upon us. If an assertion cannot be proved, then it must be settled some other way, and nearly all of these ways are unfair to somebody. It is not as if you would have to fight the Queen's champion in your own person, Mordred. You could plead infirmity and hire the strongest man you knew to fight for you, and the Queen would, of course, get the strongest man she knew to fight for her. It would be much the same thing if you each hired the best arguer you knew to argue about it. In the last resort, it is usually the richest person who wins, whether he hires the most expensive arguer or the most expensive fighter, so that it is no good pretending that this is simply a matter of brute force. No, Agravaine, he went on as the latter made a movement to speak. Don't interrupt me at the moment. I want to make it clear about these decisions by personal combat. So far as I can see, it is a matter of riches and pure luck. And, of course, there is the will of God. When the riches are equal, we might say that the luckier side wins, as if by tossing a coin. Now, are you too sure, if you did impeach Queen Guinevere of treason, that your side would be the luckier one? Agravaine entered the conversation with his imitation of diffidence. He had been drinking carefully, and his hand no longer shook. "If you will excuse me, Uncle, what I was going to say was this. We hoped to settle the matter without a personal combat at all." Arthur looked up at once. "You know quite well," he said, "the trial by ordeal has been abolished. And as for doing it by purgation, it would be impossible to find the necessary number of peers for a queen." Agravaine smiled. "We don't know much about the new law," he said smoothly, "but we thought that when an assertion could be proved in one of these new law courts of yours, then the need for personal combat did not arise. Of course, we may be wrong." "Trial by jury," observed Sir Mordred contemptuously. "Is that what you call it, some pie-powder affair?" Agravaine, exulting in his cold mind, thought, "Hoist with his own petard." The king drummed his fingers on the arm of the chair. They were pressing, flanking, and driving him back. He said slowly, "You know a great deal about the law. For instance, Uncle, if Lancelot were actually found in Guinevere's bed, in front of witnesses, then there would be no need for combat, would there?" "If you will forgive my saying so, Agravaine, I would prefer you to speak of your aunt by her title, at least in front of me, even in this connection."
"Aunt Jenny," remarked Mordred.
"Yes. I believe I have heard Sir Lancelot calling her by that name."
"Aunt Jenny, Sir Lancelot, if you will forgive my saying so, and they are probably kissing now."
"You must speak civilly, Mordred, or you must leave my room." "I'm sure he does not mean to be presumptuous, Uncle. It is only that he is upset about the dishonour to your fair fame. We wanted to ask for justice, and Mordred feels so deeply, well, for his house. Don't you, Mordred?"
"I don't care a damn about my house."
The king, whose face had begun to look more haggard, sighed and retained his patience. "Well, Mordred," he said, "we had better not start wrangling about smaller things. I have no longer the resistance to be rude about them.
You tell me that my wife is the mistress of my best friend, and apparently you are to prove this by demonstration, so let us stick to that. I take it that you understand the implications of the charge.
No, I do not.
I am sure that Agravain will, at all events. The implications are these. If you insist on a civil proof, instead of an appeal to the Court of Honour, the matter will go forward along the lines of civil proof. Should you establish your case, the man who saved you both from Sir Turquin will have his head cut off, and my wife, whom I love very much, will have to be burned alive for treason. Should you fail to establish your case, I must warn you that I should banish you, Mordred, which would deprive you of all hope of succession, such as it is, while I should condemn Agravain to the stake in his turn, because by making the accusation he would himself have committed treason. Everybody knows that we could establish our case at once. Very well, Agravain. You are a keen lawyer, and you are determined to have the law. I suppose it is no good reminding you that there is such a thing as mercy.
The kind of mercy, asked Mordred, which used to set those babies adrift in boats?
Thank you, Mordred. I was forgetting. We do not want mercy, said Agravain. We want justice. I understand the situation. Arthur put his elbow on his knees and covered his eyes with his fingers. He sat drooping for a moment, collecting the powers of duty and dignity, then spoke from the shade of his hand. How do you propose to take them? The bulky man was all politeness. If you would consent, Uncle, to go away for the night, we should get together an armed band and capture Lancelot in the Queen's room. You would have to be away or he wouldn't go. I don't think I could very well set a trap for my own wife, Agravain. I think it would be just to say that the onus of proof lies with you. Yes, I think that is just. Clearly I have the right to refuse to become, well, a sort of accomplice. It is not part of my duty to go away on purpose in order to help you. No, I should be able to refuse to do that with a clear heart. But you can't refuse to go away forever. You can't spend the rest of your life chained to the Queen on purpose to keep Lancelot away. What about the hunting party you were supposed to join next week? If you don't go on that, you'll be altering your plans deliberately, so as to thwart justice. Nobody succeeds in thwarting justice, Agravain. So you will go on the hunting party, Uncle Arthur, and we have permission to break into the Queen's room if Lancelot is there. The elation in his voice was so indecent that even Mordred was disgusted. The king stood, pulling his gown round him as if for warmth. We will go.
And you will not tell them beforehand?
The man's voice tripped over itself with excitement. You won't warn them after we have made the accusation. It wouldn't be fair.
Fair?
He asked. He looked at them from an immense distance, seeming to weigh truth, justice, evil, and the affairs of men. You have our permission. His eyes came back from the distance, fixing them personally with a falcon's gleam. But if I may speak for a moment, Mordred and Agravain, as a private person, the only hope I now have left is that Lancelot will kill you both and all the witnesses, a feat which, I am proud to say, has never been beyond my Lancelot's power. And I may add this also, as a minister of justice, that if you fail for one moment in establishing this monstrous accusation,
I shall pursue you both remorselessly, with all the rigor of the laws which you yourselves have set in motion.
Chapter 6. Lancelot knew that the king had gone to hunt in the New Forest, so he was sure that the queen would send for him. It was dark in his bedroom, except for the one light in front of the holy picture, and he was pacing the floor in a dressing gown. Except for the gay dressing gown and a sort of turban wound round his head, he was ready for bed. That is, he was naked. It was a sombre room, without luxuries. The walls were bare, and there was no canopy over the small, hard couch. The windows were unglazed. They had some sort of oiled, opaque linen stretched over them. Great commanders often have these plain, campaigning bedrooms. They say that the Duke of Wellington used to sleep on a camp bed at Walmer Castle, with nothing in them except perhaps a chair or an old trunk. Lancelot's room had one coffin-like, metal-bound chest. Apart from that, and from the bed, there was nothing to be seen, except his huge sword, which stood against the wall, its straps hanging about it. There was a kettle hat lying on the chest. After some time he picked it up and carried it to the picture light, where he stood with the same puzzled expression which the boy had had so long ago, looking at his reflection in the steel. He put it down and began to march once more. When the tap came on the door, he thought it was the signal. He was picking up the sword and stretching his hand to the latch when the door opened on its own account. Gareth came in.
"May I come?"
"Gareth?" He looked at him in surprise, then said without enthusiasm, "Come in. It is nice to see you."
"Lancelot, I have come to warn you."
After a close look, the old man grinned.
"Gracious," he said, "I hope you are not going to warn me about anything serious."
"Yes, it is serious."
"Well, come in and shut the door."
"Lancelot, it is about the Queen. I don't know how to begin."
"Don't trouble to begin, then."
He took the younger man by the shoulders, began propelling him back to the door.
"It was charming of you to warn me," he said, squeezing the shoulders, "but I don't expect you can tell me anything I don't know."
"Oh, Lancelot, you know I would do anything to help you. I don't know what the others will say when they hear I have been to you, but I couldn't stay away."
"What is the trouble?"
He stopped their progress to look at him again.
"It is Agravain and Mordred. They hate you. Or Agravain does. He is jealous. Mordred hates Arthur most. We tried our best to stop them, but they would go on. Gawain says he won't have anything to do with it either way, and Gaheris was never good at making up his mind, so I had to come myself. I had to come, even if it is against my own brothers and the clan, because I owe everything to you, and I couldn't let it happen."
"My poor Gareth, what a state you have got yourself in."
"They have been to the king and told him outright that you go to the queen's bedroom. We tried to stop them, and we wouldn't stay to listen, but that is what they told."
Lancelot released the shoulder. He took two paces through the room.
"Don't be upset about it," he said, coming back. "Many people have said so before, but nothing came of it. It will blow over."
"Not this time. I can feel it won't inside me."
"Nonsense."
"It is not nonsense, Lancelot. They hate you. They won't try a combat this time, not after Meliagrance. They are too cunning. They will do something to trap you. They will go behind your back."
But the veteran only smiled and patted him.
"You are imagining things," he announced. "Go home to bed, my friend, and forget it. It was nice of you to come, but go home now and cheer up and have a good sleep. If the king had been going to make a fuss, he would never have gone off hunting."
Gareth bit his fingers, plucking up the face to speak directly.
At last he said, "Please, don't go to the Queen tonight."
Lancelot lifted one of his extraordinary eyebrows, but lowered it on second thoughts. "Why not?"
"I am sure it is a trap. I'm sure the king has gone away for the night on purpose that you should go to her, and then Agravaine will be there to catch you."
"Arthur would never do a thing like that."
"He has."
"Nonsense. I have known Arthur since you were in the nursery, and he wouldn't do it."
"But it is a risk."
"If it is a risk, I shall enjoy it."
"Please."
This time, he put his hand in the small of Gareth's back and began moving him seriously to the door. "Now, my dear kitchen page, just listen. In the first place, I know Arthur. In the second place, I know Agravaine. Do you think I ought to be afraid of him?"
"But treachery, Gareth."
"Once, when I was a young fellow, a lady came skipping past me chasing after a peregrine which had snapped its creance. The trailing part of the creance got wound up in a tree, and the peregrine hung there at the top. The lady persuaded me to climb the tree to get her hawk. I was never much of a climber. When I did get to the top and had freed the hawk, the lady's husband turned up in full armour and said he was going to chop my head off. All the hawk business had been a trap to get me out of my armour, so that he would have me at his mercy. I was in the tree, in my shirt, without even a dagger."
"Yes?"
"Well, I knocked him on the head with a branch, and he was a much better man than poor old Agravaine, even if we have grown rheumaticky since those bright days."
"I know you can deal with Agravaine, but suppose he attacks you with an armed band?"
"He won't do anything."
"He will."
There was a scratch at the door, a gentle drumming. A mouse might have made it, but Lancelot's eyes grew vague. "Well, if he does," he said shortly, "then I shall have to fight the band. But the situation is imaginary."
"Couldn't you stay away tonight?"
They had reached the door, and the king's captain spoke decisively. "Look," he said, "if you must know, the Queen has sent for me. I could hardly refuse once I was sent for, could I?"
"So my treachery to the old ones will be useless?"
"Not useless. Anybody who knew would love you for facing it. But we can trust Arthur."
"And you will go in spite of everything?"
"Yes, kitchen page, and I shall go this minute. Good gracious, don't look so tragic about it. Leave it to the practiced scoundrel and run away to bed."
"It means goodbye."
"Nonsense. It means good night. And what is more, the Queen is waiting." The old man swung a mantle over his shoulder as easily as if he were still in the pride of youth. He lifted the latch and stood in the doorway, wondering what he had forgotten.
"If only I could stop you."
"Alas, you can't." He stepped into the darkness of the passage, dismissing the subject from his mind, and disappeared. What he had forgotten was his sword. Chapter 7. Guinevere waited for Lancelot in the candlelight of her splendid bedroom, brushing her grey hair. She looked singularly lovely, not like a film star, but like a woman who had grown a soul. She was singing by herself. It was a hymn, of all things, the beautiful Veni Sancte Spiritus, which is supposed to have been written by a pope. The candle flames, rising up stilly on the night air, were reflected from the golden lion cells which studded the deep blue canopy of the bed. The combs and brushes sparkled with ornaments in cut paste. A large chest of polished latoon had saints and angels enamelled in the panels. The brocaded hangings beamed on the walls in soft folds, and on the floor, a desperate and reprehensible luxury, there was a genuine carpet. It made people shy when they walked on it, since carpets were not originally intended for mere floors. Arthur used to walk round it. Guinevere was singing and brushing, her low voice fitting the stillness of the candles, when the door opened softly. The commander-in-chief dropped his black cloak on the chest and stepped across to stand beside her. She saw him in the mirror without surprise. "May I do it for you?"
"If you like."
He took the brush and began sweeping it through the silver avalanche with fingers which were deft from practice, while the queen closed her eyes. After a time he spoke.
"It is like... I don't know what. Not like silk. It is more like pouring water. Only there is something cloudy about it, too. The clouds are made of water, aren't they? Is it a pale mist, or a winter sea, or a waterfall, or a hayrick in the frost? Yes, it is a hayrick, deep and soft and full of scent."
"It is a nuisance," she said.
"It is the sea," he said solemnly, "in which I was born."
The queen opened her eyes and asked, "Did you come safely?"
"Nobody saw."
"Arthur said he was coming back tomorrow."
"Did he? Here is a white hair."
"Pull it out."
"Poor hair," he said. "It is a thin one. Why is your hair so beautiful, Jenny? I should have to plait about 6 of them together to be as thick as one of mine. Shall I pull?"
"Yes, pull."
"Did it hurt?"
"No."
"Why didn't it? When I was small, I used to pull my sister's hair, and they used to pull mine, and it hurt like fury. Do we lose our faculties as we get older, so that we can't feel our pains and joys?"
"No," she explained. "It is because you only pulled one of them. When you pull a whole lock together, then it hurts. Look." He held down his head so that she could reach, and she, stretching up backwards with a white arm, twisted his forelock round her finger. She tugged until he made a face.
"Yes, it still hurts. What a relief."
"Was that how your sisters pulled it?"
"Yes, but I pulled theirs much harder. Whenever I came near one of my sisters, she used to hold her pigtails in both hands and glare at me."
She laughed. "I'm glad I wasn't one of your sisters."
"Oh, but I should never have pulled yours. Yours is too beautiful. I should have wanted to do something else with it."
"What would you have done?"
"I should... well, I think I should have curled up inside it like a dormouse and gone to sleep. I should like to do that now."
"Not until it is finished."
"Jenny," he asked suddenly, "do you think this will last?"
"What do you mean?"
"Gareth came to me just now to warn us that Arthur had gone away on purpose to set a trap, and that Agravain or Mordred was going to catch us out."
"Arthur would never do a thing like that."
"That's what I said."
"Unless he was made to," she reflected.
"I don't see how they could make him."
She went off at a tangent. "It was nice of Gareth to go against his brothers. Do you know, I think he is one of the nicest people at court. Gawain is decent, but he's quick-tempered and rather unforgiving."
"He is loyal."
"Yes. Arthur used to say that if you were not an Orkney, they were frightful. But if you were, you were a lucky man. They fight like cats, but they adore each other, really. It is a clan." The Queen's tangent had somehow brought her back to the circle. "Lance," she asked in a startled voice, "do you think they could have forced the King's hand?"
"How do you mean?"
"Arthur has a terrific sense of justice."
"I wonder."
"There was that conversation last week. I thought he was trying to warn us. Listen!" "Did you hear something?"
"No."
"I thought I heard somebody at the door."
"I'll go and see."
He went to the door and opened it, but there was nobody there.
"A false alarm."
"Bolt it, then." He slid the wooden beam across, a great bar of oak 5 inches thick, which slid into a channel deep in the thickness of the wall. Coming back to the candlelight, he separated the shining hair into convenient strands and began to plait them swiftly. His hands moved like shuttles.
"It is silly to be nervous," he observed.
She was still speculating, however, and replied with a question. "Do you remember Tristram and Isolde?"
"Of course."
"Tristram used to sleep with King Mark's wife, and the king murdered him for it."
"Tristram was a lout."
"I thought he was nice."
"That is what he wanted you to think. But he was a Cornish knight like the rest of them."
"He was said to be the second best knight in the world. Sir Lancelot, Sir Tristram, Sir Lamorack."
"That was tittle-tattle."
"Why did you think he was a lout?" she asked.
"Well, it's a long story. You don't remember what chivalry used to be before your Arthur started the table, so you don't know what a genius you have married. You don't see what a difference there is between Tristram and, well, Gareth, for instance."
"What difference?"
"In the old days it was a case of every knight for himself. The old stagers, people like Sir Bruce Saunce-Pittier, were pirates. They knew they were impregnable in armour, and they did as they pleased. It was open manslaughter and bold bawdry. When Arthur came to the throne, they were furious. You see, he believed in right and wrong."
"He still does."
"Fortunately, he had a tenacious character as well as this idea of his. It took him about 5 years to set it on foot, but it was that people ought to be gentle. I must have been one of the first knights to catch the idea of gentleness from him, and I caught it young, and he made it part of my inside. Everybody is always saying, 'What a parfit, gentle knight I am,' but it has nothing to do with me. It is Arthur's idea. It is what he has wished on all the younger generation, like Gareth. And now it is fashionable. It led to the quest for the Grail."
"And why was Tristram allowed?"
"Well, he just was. Arthur says he was a buffoon. He lived in Cornwall. He had never been educated by Arthur, but he had got wind of the fashion. He had got some garbled notion into his head that famous knights ought to be gentle, and he was always rushing about trying to live up to the fashion, without properly understanding it or feeling it in himself. He was a sort of copycat. Inside, he was not a bit gentle. He was foul to his wife. He was always bullying poor old Palomides for being black, and he treated King Mark most shamefully. The knights from Cornwall are old ones, and have always been hostile to Arthur's idea inside themselves, even if they do get hold of a part of it."
"Like Agravaine?"
"Yes. Agravaine's mother was from Cornwall. The reason why Agravaine hates me is because I stand for the idea. It's a funny thing, but all three of us that the common people used to call the three best knights, I mean Lamorack, Tristram, and myself, have been hated by the old ones. They were delighted when Tristram was murdered because he copied the idea. And of course, it was the Gawain family who actually killed Sir Lamorack by treachery."
"I think," she said, "that the reason why Agravaine hates you is the old story of sour grapes. I don't think he cares a bit about the idea, but he naturally envies anybody who is a better fighter than himself. He loathed Tristram because of the thrashing he got from him on the way to Joyous Gard, and he helped to murder Lamorack because the boy had beaten him at the Priory Jousts. And how many times have you upset him?"
"I don't remember."
"Lance, do you realize that the two other people he hated are dead?"
"Everybody dies sooner or later."
Suddenly the Queen had swept her plaits out of his fingers. She had twisted round in the chair, and with one hand holding a pigtail, she was staring at him with round eyes.
"I believe it is true, what Gareth said. I believe they are coming to catch us tonight."
She jumped out of the chair and began pushing him to the door.
"Go away!" Go while there is time.
But Jenny...
No, no buts. I know it is true. I can feel it. Here's your cloak. Oh, Lance, please go quickly. They stabbed Sir Lamorak in the back.
Come, Jenny, don't get excited about nothing. It's only a fancy.
It is not a fancy. Listen. Listen.
I can't hear anything.
Look at the door.
The handle which lifted the latch of the door, a piece of wrought iron shaped like a horseshoe, was moving softly to the left. It moved like a crab, uncertainly. What is the matter with the door?
Look at the handle!
They stood watching it in fascination, as it moved, blindly, in jerks, a sly, hesitating exploration.
Oh, God, she whispered, and now it is too late!
The handle fell back into place, and there was a loud iron knocking on the wood of the door. It was a good door of double ply, one grain running vertically and the other horizontally, and it was being beaten from the other side with a gauntlet. Agravain's voice, echoing in the cavern of his helmet, cried,
"Open the door, in the king's name!"
"We are undone," she said.
"Traitor knight!" cried the neighing voice, as the wood thundered under the metal. "Sir Lancelot, now art thou taken!"
Many more voices joined the outcry. Many joints of harness, no longer under the necessity of precaution, clanked on the stone stair. The door butted against its beam. Lancelot dropped unconsciously into the language of chivalry also.
"Is there any armour in the chamber?" he asked, "that I might cover my body withal?"
"There is nothing, not even a sword."
He stood facing the door, with a puzzled, businesslike expression, biting his fingers. Several fists were hammering at it, so that it shook, and the voices were like a pack of hounds.
"Oh, Lancelot," she said, "there is nothing to fight with, and you are almost naked. They are armed, and many. You will be killed, and I shall be burned, and our love has come to a bitter end."
He was cross at not being able to solve the problem.
"If only I had my armour," he said with irritation. "It seems ridiculous to be caught like a rat in a trap."
He looked round the room, cursing himself for having forgotten his weapon.
"Traitor knight!" boomed the voice. "Come out of the queen's chamber!"
Another voice, musical and self-possessed, cried pleasantly,
"Wit thou well! Here are 14 armed, and thou canst not escape."
It was Mordred, and the hammering was growing louder.
"Well, damn them then," he said. "We can't have this noise. I shall have to go, or they will wake the castle."
He turned to the queen and took her in his arms. "Jenny, I am going to call you my most noble Christian queen. Will you be strong?"
"My dear..."
"My sweet old Jenny, let us have a kiss. Now, you have always been my special good lady, and we have never failed before. Do not be frightened this time. If they kill me, remember Sir Bor. All my brothers and nephews will look after you. Send a message to Bor or Damaris, and they will rescue you if necessary. They will take you safe to Joyous Gard, and you can live there on my own land like the queen you are. Do you understand?"
"If you are killed, I shall not want to be rescued."
"You will," he said firmly. "It is important that somebody should be alive to explain about us decently. That is the hard work which you will have to do. Besides, I should want you to pray."
"No. The prayers will have to be done by somebody else. If they kill you, they can burn me. I shall take my death as meekly as any Christian queen."
He kissed her tenderly and set her in the chair.
"Too late to argue," he said. "I know you will be Jenny whatever happens, and I must e'en be Lancelot."
Then, still glancing round the room with a preoccupied look, he added absent-mindedly, "It makes no odds about my quarrel,
but they did ill to force it on you." She watched him, trying not to cry. "I would give my foot," he said, "to have a little armour, even just a sword, so that they could remember."
"Lance, if they would kill me and save you, I should be happy."
"And I should be extremely miserable," he answered, suddenly finding himself in intense good humour. "Well, well, we shall have to do the best we can. Bother my very old bones, but I believe I am going to enjoy it."
He put the candles on the lid of the Limoges chest so that they would be behind his back when he opened the door. He picked up his black cloak and folded it carefully lengthwise into four, after which he wound it round his left hand and forearm as a protection. He picked up the footstool from beside the bed, balanced it in his right hand, and took a last look round the room. All the time the noise was getting louder outside, and two men were evidently trying to cut through the wood with their battle axes, an attempt which was frustrated by the cross grains of the double ply. He went to the door and raised his voice, at which there was immediate silence.
"Fair lords," he said, "leave your noise and your rashing. I shall set open this door, and then ye may do with me what it liketh you." "Come off, then," they cried confusedly. "Do it! It availeth thee not to strive against us all. Let us into the chamber! We shall save thy life if you come to King Arthur."
He put his shoulder against the leaping door and softly pushed the beam back into the wall. Then, still holding the door shut with his shoulder, the people on the other side had desisted from their hewing, feeling that something was about to happen, he settled his right foot firmly on the ground about 2 feet from the door jamb and let the door swing open. It stopped with a jerk at his foot, leaving a narrow opening, so that it was more ajar than open, and a single knight in full armour blundered through the gap with the obedience of a puppet on strings. Lancelot slammed the door behind him, shot the bar, took the figure's sword by the pommel in his padded left hand, jerked him forward, tripped him up, bashed him on the head with the stool as he was falling, and was sitting on his chest in a trice, as limber as he had ever been. All was done with what seemed to be ease and leisure, as if it were the armed man who was powerless. The great turret of a fellow who had entered in the height and breadth of armour, and who had stood for a second looking for his adversary through the slit of his helmet, this man had given an impression of docility. He seemed to have come in, and to have handed his sword to Lancelot, and to have thrown himself upon the ground. Now the iron hulk lay as obediently as ever, while the bare-legged man pressed its own sword-point through the ventail of the visor. It made a few protesting shudders as he pressed down with both hands on the pommel of the sword. Lancelot stood up, rubbing his hands on the dressing-gown. "I'm sorry I had to kill him." He opened the visor and looked. "Agravain of Orkney." There was a terrific outcry from beyond the door, with hammering, hewing, and cursing, as Lancelot turned to the Queen. "Help with the armour," he said briefly. She came at once, without repugnance, and they kneeled together beside the body, stripping it of the vital pieces. "Listen," he said as they worked, "this gives us a fair chance. If I can drive them off, I shall turn back for you, and you will come to Joyous Gard."
"No, Lance, we have done enough harm. If you do fight your way out, you must keep away till it blows over. I shall stay here. If Arthur forgives me, and if it can be hushed up, then you can come back later. If he does not forgive me, you can come to the rescue."
"Where does this go?"
"Give it to me."
"Here is the other one."
"You were far better to come," he urged, struggling into the habergeon like a footballer putting on his jersey.
"No. If I come, everything is broken for ever. If I stay, we may be able to patch it up. You can always rescue me if necessary."
"I don't like to leave you."
"If I am condemned and you rescue me, I promise I will come to Joyous Gard."
"And if not?"
"Wipe the helmet with your cloak," she said. "If not, then you can come back later, and everything will be as it was."
Very well. There, I can do without the rest. He straightened himself, holding the bloody sword, and looked at the dead body which had killed its mother. Gareth's brother, he said thoughtfully. Perhaps he was drunk. God rest him, though it seems absurd to say it. The old lady turned him to face the candles.
It means goodbye, she whispered, for a little.
It means goodbye.
Give me a kiss, she asked.
He kissed her hand, because he was armed and dirty with blood and covered with metal. They thought simultaneously of the 13 men outside.
I should like you to take something of mine, Lance, and to leave me something of yours. Will you change rings?
They changed them.
God be with my ring, she said, as I am with it.
Lancelot turned away and went to the door. They were calling out, Come out of the Queen's chamber! Traitor to the King, open the door! They were making as much noise as possible to aid the scandal. He stood facing the tumult, with legs apart, and answered them in the language of honour. Leave your noise, Sir Mordred, and take my counsel. Go ye all from this chamber door, and make not such crying and such manner of slander as ye do. An ye will depart, and make no more noise, I shall to morn appear before the king, and then it will be seen which of you all, Arthur else you all, will accuse me of treason. There shall I answer you as a knight should, that hither I came for no manner of malingin, and I will prove that there, and make it good upon you with my hands. Fie on thee, traitor! Cried the voice of Mordred. We will have thee maugre thy head, and slay thee if we list. Another voice shouted, Let thee wit we have the choice of King Arthur, to save thee or to slay thee. Lancelot dropped the visor over his shadowed face, and pushed the door bar sideways with his point. The stout wood, crashing open, showed a lintel crammed with iron men and tossing torches. Ah, sirs, he said with a grimness, is there none other grace with you? Then keep yourselves!
Chapter 8 The Gawain clan was waiting in the justice room a week later. The room looked different by daylight because the windows were uncovered. It was no longer a box, no longer that faintly threatening or deceitful blandness of four walls, no longer the kind of arras trap which tempted Hamlet's rapier to prick about for rats. The afternoon sunlight streamed in at the casements, illuminating the tapestry of Bathsheba as she sat with her two round breasts in a tub on the battlements of a castle, which seemed to have been built from children's bricks, picking out David on the roof next door, with a crown and a beard and a harp, rippling from 100 horses, parallel lances, helms and suits of armour, which thronged the battle scene in which Uriah was killed. Uriah himself was tumbling from his horse, like rather an inexperienced diver, under the influence of a stroke which one of the opposing knights had delivered in the region of his midriff. The sword was halfway through his body, so that the poor man was coming in two pieces, and a lot of realistic vermilion worms were gushing out of the wound in a grisly manner, which were intended to be his guts. Gawain sat gloomily on one of the side benches, placed there for petitioners, with his arms folded and his head against the arras. Gaheris, perched on the long table, was fiddling with the braces of a leather hood for a hawk. He was trying to alter them so that they would shut more firmly, and as the interlacement of such braces was complicated, he had got himself in a muddle. Gareth was standing beside him, itching to get the hood into his own hands, because he was certain that he could set the matter right. Mordred, with a white face and his arm in a sling, was leaning at the embrasure of one of the windows, looking out. He was still in pain.
"It ought to go under the slit," said Gareth.
"I know, but I'm trying to put this one through first.
Let me try. Just a minute. It's coming.
Mordred said from the window, The executioner is ready to begin.
Oh.
It will be a cruel death, he said. They are using seasoned wood, and there will be no smoke, and she will burn before she suffocates.
So ye believe, observed Sir Gawain morosely.
Poor old woman, said Mordred. One can almost feel sorry for her.
Gareth turned on him fiercely. You should have thought of that before.
Now the top one, said Gaheris. I understand, continued Mordred, in what was almost a soliloquy, that our liege lord himself must watch the execution from this window.
Gareth lost his temper completely. Can't you hold your tongue about it for a minute? Anyone would think that you enjoyed watching people being burned.
Mordred replied contemptuously, So will you, really. Only you think it is not good form to say so. They will burn her in her shift.
For the sake of God, be silent!
Gaheris said in his slow way, I don't think you need to worry.
In a flash, Mordred was facing him. What do you mean, he need not worry?
Of course he need no worry, said Gawain angrily. Do you think that Lancelot will not come to rescue her? He is no coward, at any rate.
Mordred was thinking quickly. His still pose by the window had given place to nervous excitement.
If he tries to rescue her, there will be a fight. King Arthur will have to fight him.
King Arthur will watch from here.
But this is monstrous, he exploded. Do you mean to say that Lancelot will be allowed to slip off with the Queen under our noses?
That is exactly what will happen.
But nobody will be punished at all.
Good heavens, man, cried Gareth. Do you want to see the woman burn?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Gawain, are you going to sit there and let this happen after your own brother has been killed?
I warn it, Agravain.
You cowards! Gareth, Gaheris, make him do something. You can't let this happen. He murdered Agravain, your brother.
So far as I can understand the story, Mordred, Agravain went with 13 other knights, fully armed, and tried to kill Lancelot when he had nothing but his dressing gown. The upshot was that Agravain himself was killed, together with all 13 of the knights, except one, who ran away.
I did not run away!
Ye survive it, Mordred.
Gawain, I swear I didn't run away. I fought him as well as I could, but he broke my arm, and then I could do no more. On my honour, Gawain, I tried to fight.
He was almost weeping.
I am not a coward.
If you didn't run away, asked Gaheris, how came it that Lancelot let you go after killing the others? It was in his interest to kill the lot of you, because then there would have been no witnesses.
He broke my arm.
Yes. But he didn't kill you.
I am telling the truth.
But he didn't kill you.
What with the pain of his arm and rage, the man began to cry like a child.
You traitors! It is always like this. Because I am not strong, you side against me. You stand for the muscular fools and will not believe what I say. Agravain is dead and waked, and you are not going to punish anybody for it. Traitors! Traitors! And it will all be as it was!
He broke down as the king came in. Arthur, looking tired, walked slowly to the throne and set himself on it. He motioned to them to resume their seats. Gawain slumped back on the bench from which he had risen, while Gareth and Gaheris remained standing, observing the king with looks of pity, to the background of Mordred's sobs. Arthur stroked his forehead with his hand.
Why is he crying? He asked.
He was for explaining to us, said Gawain, how Lancelot killed 13 knights, but resolve it on his second thoughts that he shouldna kill our Mordred. It was by cause there was a fondness between them, seemingly.
I think I can explain. You see, I asked Sir Lancelot not to kill my son 10 days ago. Mordred said bitterly,
Thank you for nothing!
You don't have to thank me, Mordred. Lancelot would be the right person to thank for that.
I wish he had killed me!
I am glad he did not. Try to be a little forgiving, my son, now that we are in this trouble. Remember that I am your father. I shall have no family left except for you.
I wish I had never been born!
So do I, my poor boy. But you are born, so now we must do the best we can. Mordred went over to him with haste, with a sort of shamefaced dissimulation.
Father, he said, do you know that Lancelot is bound to come and rescue her?
I have been expecting it.
And you have posted knights to stop him? You have arranged for a strong guard?
The guard is as strong as it can be, Mordred. I have tried to be just.
Father, he said eagerly, send Gawain and these two to strengthen them. He will come with great force.
Well, Gawain? Asked the king.
Thank ye, uncle. I had liefer ye didna ask.
I ought to ask you, Gawain, out of justice to the guard which is already there. You see, it would be unfair to leave a weak guard if I thought that Lancelot was coming, because that would be treachery to my own men. It would be sacrificing them.
Whether ye ask me or no, saving your majesty, I shall na go. I warned the twa of them at the outsetting that I wouldna have to do with it. I've nae wish to see Queen Guinevere burn, and I maun say I hope she willna, nor will I help to burn her. There ye have it.
It sounds like treason.
It may be treason, but I have my fondness for the Queen.
I also am fond of the Queen, Gawain. It was I who married her. But where a matter of public justice arises, the feelings of common people have to be left out.
I fear I canna leave my feelings.
The king turned to the others. Gareth, Gaheris, will you oblige me by putting on your armour and strengthening the guard?
Uncle, please don't ask us.
It gives me no pleasure to ask you, Gareth. I know it doesn't, but please don't force us. Lancelot is my friend, so how could I fight against him? The king touched his hand.
Lancelot would have expected you to go, my dear, whoever it was against. He believes in justice, too.
Uncle, I can't fight him. He knighted me. I will go if you wish, but I won't go in armour. I am afraid that mine is treason, too.
I am ready to go in armour, said Mordred,
even if my arm is broken.
Gawain observed sarcastically,
It will be safe enough for you, my manny. We ken the king has bidden Lancelot not to hurt ye.
Traitor!
And Gaheris? Asked the king.
I will go with Gareth, unarmed.
Well, I suppose it is the best we can do. I hope I have tried to do what I ought. Gawain got up from his bench and tramped over to the king with clumsy sympathy.
You have done more than e'er a body could expect, he said warmly, holding the veined hand in his paw. And now we must look onward for the best. Let my brothers go unarmed. He will na hurt them, gin he sees their faces. I maun stay ben with you.
Go then.
Shall I tell the executioner to begin?
Yes, if you must, Mordred. Give him my ring and get the warrant from Sir Bedivere.
Thank you, Father, thank you. We shall be hardly a minute.
The pale face burning with enthusiasm, and for the moment with a strangely genuine gratitude, hurried from the room. He followed his brothers, who had gone to join the guard, with blazing eyes and a nervous twitch of his mouth. The old king, left behind with Gawain, sank his head upon his hands. He might have done it with a little more decency. He might have tried to show that he was not so pleased.
Gawain put his hand on the stooping shoulder.
Never fear, uncle, he said. It will come to right. Lancelot will rescue her in God's good time, and nae harm done.
I have tried to do my duty.
Ye have striven to admiration.
I sentenced her because it was the law to sentence her. I have done my best to see the sentence will be carried out.
But it will not be. Lancelot will bring her safe.
Gawain, you are not to think that I am trying to get her rescued. I am the justice of England, and it is our business now to burn her to death without remorse.
Aye, uncle, and every man kens fine how ye have tried, but that dinna alter the truth, that we both desire at heart she may come safe.
Oh, Gawain, he said, I have been married to her all these years.
The other turned his back and went to the window.
Dinna disturb yourself. The coil will come to right.
What is right?
Cried the old man, looking after him with a face of misery. What is wrong?
If Lancelot does come to rescue her, he may kill those innocent fellows of the guard which I have set to burn her. They have trusted me, and I have put them there to keep him off because it is justice. If he saves her, they will be killed. If they are not killed, she will be burned, but burned to death, Gawain, in horrible burning flames. And she is my much-loved Gwen.
Dinna think about it, uncle. It will na happen.
But the king was breaking down.
Why doesn't he come at once, then? Why does he wait so long?
Gawain said steadily, he has to wait until she is in the open, in the square, for otherwise it would mean to storm the castle.
I tried to warn them, Gawain. I tried to warn them a few days before they were caught. But it was difficult to say the things in plain English, without hurting people's feelings. And I was a fool, too. I didn't want to be conscious of it. I hoped that if only I was not quite conscious of everything, it would come straight in the end. Do you think it was my fault? Do you think I could have saved them if I had done something else?
You did the best you could.
When I was a young man, I did something which was not just, and from it has sprung the misery of my life. Do you think you can stop the consequences of a bad action by doing good ones afterwards? I don't. I've been trying to stopper it down with good actions ever since, but it goes on in widening circles. It will not be stoppered. Do you think this is a consequence too?
A dinner, Ken.
How horrible it is to wait like this! He cried. It must be worse for Gwen. Why can't they bring her out at once to have done with it?
They will do so soon.
And it is not her fault. Is it mine? Ought I to have refused to accept Mordred's evidence and overridden the whole affair? Ought I to have acquitted her? I could have set my new law aside. Ought I to have done that?
Ye might have done.
I could have acted as I wished.
Aye.
But what would have happened to justice then? What would have been the consequence?
Consequences, justice,
bad deeds, babies drowned. I could see them about me all last night.
Gawain spoke quietly in a changed voice.
Ye must forget sick things. Ye maun summon up your powers to what is difficult. Will ye do that?
The king held the arms of his throne.
Yes. I fear ye must come to the window. They are for bringing her out.
The old man made no movement, except that his fingers tightened on the wood. He sat staring in front of him. Then he pulled himself to his feet, taking his weight on the wrists, and went to his duty. Unless he was present at the execution, it would not be a legal one.
"She is in a white shift."
They stood together quietly, watching like people who must not feel. There was a numbness in their crisis which forced language into conversational levels.
"Aye. What are they doing?"
"I dinna ken."
"Praying, I suppose."
"Aye. Yon is the bishop in front."
They examined the praying.
"How strange they look."
"They're just ordinary."
"Do you think I could sit down?" he asked, like a child. "Now that I have shown myself."
"Ye maun stay."
"I don't think I can."
"Ye must."
"But Gawain, if she were to glance up..."
"If ye dinna stay, it will na be right at law."
Outside in the foreshortened marketplace under the window, they seemed to be singing a hymn. It was impossible to distinguish the words or melody. They could see the processional clerics busy about the decencies of death, and the twinkling knights standing motionless, and the people's heads, like baskets of coconuts, round the outside of the square. It was not easy to see the Queen. She was too much obscured in the eddies of the ceremonial, being led in this and that direction, being converged upon by small coveys of officials or of confessors, being introduced to the executioner, being persuaded to kneel down and pray, being exhorted to stand up and make a speech, being aspersed, being given candles to hold, being forgiven and being asked to forgive, being carried patiently onward, being ushered out of life with circumstance and dignity. There was nothing dingy, at any rate, about a legal murder in the age of darkness. The king asked,
"Can you see any rescue coming?"
"Nay."
"It seems a long time."
Outside the window, the chanting ceased, making a distressing silence.
"How much longer?"
"Some minutes yet."
"They will let her pray."
"Aye, they will let her."
The old man suddenly asked,
"Do you think we ought to pray?"
"If you wish it."
"Ought we to kneel down?"
"A doubt it matters."
"What shall we say?"
"A dinner ken."
"Shall I say the Our Father? It is all I can remember."
"That will do fine."
"Shall we say it together?"
"If you wish it."
"Gawain, I fear I must kneel down."
"I will stand," said the Laird of Orkney.
"Now."
They were beginning their unprofessional petition when the faint bugle sounded from beyond the market.
"Whisht, uncle!"
The prayer fell at mid-word.
"There are soldiers coming. Horses, I think."
Arthur was on his feet, was at the window.
"Where?" "The trumpet!"
And now, clear, shrill, exultant, the song of brass was piercing the room itself. The king, shaking Gawain by the elbow, with trembling voice began to cry,
"My Lancelot! I knew he would!"
Gawain forced his heavy shoulders through the frame. They were jealous for the view.
"Aye, it is Lancelot! Look at him! In silver! The argent, a Ben Gules,
the bonny rider.
Look at them all."
Indeed, it was worth looking. The marketplace was an avalanche, like a scene from the Wild West. The baskets of fruit were broken so that the coconuts poured down. The knights of the guard were mounting, hopping beside their chargers with one foot in the stirrup, while each horse revolved about the axis of its rider. The acolytes were throwing away their censers. The priests were butting their way through the crowd. The bishop, who wanted to stay, was being bundled away towards the church, while his crozier came after him like a standard, carried high above the tumult by some faithful deacon. A canopy, which had been carried on four poles over somebody or something, was sinking with the poles askew, like a liner floundering in the Atlantic.
the onrushing tide of flashing cavalry with clanking arms and brassy music poured into the square with feathers tossing as if they were the heads of Indians, their swords rising and falling like a strange machinery. Abandoned by the cluster of ministrants who had obscured her as the last rites were being offered, Guinevere stood like a beacon. In her white shift, tied to the high stake, she remained motionless in the movement. She rode above them. The battle closed about her feet.
What spurring and plucking up of horses!
Nay other body ever charged like yon.
Oh, the poor guard!
Arthur was wringing his hands.
Some man is down.
It is Seguarides!
What a melee!
His charges, stated the king vehemently, were always irresistible, always. Ah, what a thrust!
There goes Sir Pertilope.
No, it is Perimenes. It is his brother.
Look at the brass swords in the sun. Look at the colours. Well struck, Sir Gillimer, well struck!
Oh, no! Look at Lancelot! Look how he thrangs and rashes! There is Aglovale unhorsed! Look, he is coming to the queen!
Priamus will stop him!
Priamus, nonsense! We shall win, Gawain, we shall win!
The big fellow twisted round, grinning with enthusiasm.
What is we?
Very well! They, then, you chucklehead! Sir Lancelot, of course, he will win!
There goes Sir Priamus! Sir Bor is down!
No matter! They will horse Bor again in a minute. Here he is, coming to the queen. Oh, look! He has brought her a kirtle and a gown!
Aye, has he!
My Lancelot would not let my Guinevere be seen in her shift!
He wouldna.
He is putting them on her.
She is smiling.
Bless them both, the creatures. But oh, the foot people.
It is finished, you might say.
He won't do more execution than he need. We can trust him for that.
We can trust the man for that.
Is that Damas under the horse?
Aye, Damas had ever a red panache. I think they're for drawing off. How quick they have been.
Guinevere is up!
The bugle music touched the room again, a different call.
There must be a way. That is the retreat. Lord, Lord, will you look at the confusion?
I hope there are not too many hurt. Can you see? Ought we to have gone to their help?
There will be many stiff from this, said Gawain.
The faithful guard!
Above the dozen.
My brave men, and it is my fault.
I dinna see that it was the fault of any man particular, unless it was my brother's, and he now dead. Aye, there gangs the last of them. You can see the queen's white gown above the press.
Shall I wave to her?
No.
It would not be right.
No.
Well, then, I suppose I must not. Still, it would have been nice to do something as she is going.
Gawain turned upon him with a swirl of affection.
"Uncle Arthur," he said, "you're a grand man. I told ye it would come to right."
"And you are a grand man too, Gawain. A good man and a kind one."
They kissed in the ancient way, joyfully, on both cheeks.
"There," they said. "There."
"And now what is to be done?"
"That is for you to say."
The old king looked about him as if he were searching for the thing to do. His age, the suggestion of infirmity, had lifted from him. He looked straighter. His cheeks were rosy. The crow's feet round his eyes were beaming.
"I think we ought to have a monstrous drink to begin with." "Very good. Call the page."
"Page! Page!" he cried at the door. "Where the devil have you gone? Page! Here, you varmint! Bring us some drink! What have you been doing? Watching your mistress being burned? And a very good cell for you!"
The delighted child gave a squeak and rattled down the stairs again, which he was halfway up.
"And then? After the drink?"
asked Gawain. Arthur came back cheerfully, rubbing his hands.
I have not thought. Something will happen. Perhaps we can make Lancelot apologize, or some arrangement like that, and then he can come back. We could get him to explain that he was in the Queen's bedroom because she had sent for him to pay the Meleagrance fee, as she had briefed him, and she didn't want to have any talk about the payment. And then, of course, he had to rescue her because he knew she was innocent. Yes, I think we could manage something like that. But they would have to behave themselves in future.
Gawain's enthusiasm had evaporated before his uncle's. He spoke slowly with his eyes on the floor.
I doubt, he began.
The king looked at him.
I doubt ye will ever patch it up in full, while Mordred is on life.
Lifting the tapestry of the doorway with a pale hand, the ghostly creature in half-armour, its unarmed elbow in a sling, stood on the threshold.
Never, it said, with the bitter drama of a perfect cue, while Mordred is alive.
Arthur turned round in surprise. He surveyed the feverish eyes, then went to his son with a movement of concern.
Why Mordred?
Why Arthur?
Dinna speak to the king like yon. How dare ye?
Do not speak to me at all.
Its toneless voice had stopped the king halfway. Now he pulled himself together.
Come, he said kindly. It has been a terrible carnage, we know. We saw it from the window. But surely it is better that your aunt should be safe and all the forms of justice satisfied.
It has been a terrible carnage.
The voice was that of an automaton, but deep with meaning.
The Foot People.
Trash!
Gawain was turning on his half-brother like a mechanism. His whole body turned.
Mordred, he asked with a cumbrous accent. Mordred, why have you left Sir Gareth?
Where have I left them both?
The red man began to ejaculate, making his words fast.
Dinna ape me, he shouted. Dinna cry like a parrot. Speak where they are.
Go and look for them, Gawain. Among the people on the square.
Arthur began.
Gareth and Gaheris
are lying in the marketplace. It was difficult to recognize them because of the blood.
They are not hurt, surely. They were unarmed. They are not wounded.
They are dead.
Havers, Mordred.
Havers, Gawain.
But they had no armour, protested the king.
They had no armour.
Gawain said with frightful emphasis,
Mordred, if ye are telling a lie...
The righteous Gawain will slay the last of his kin.
Mordred!
Arthur,
he replied. He turned on him a face of stone, insanely mixed between venom, blandness, and misery.
If it is true, it is terrible. Who could have wanted to kill Gareth and him unarmed?
Who?
They were not even going to fight. They were going to stand by because I told them to. Besides, Lancelot is Gareth's best friend. The boy was friendly with the Ban family. It seems impossible. Are you sure you are not making a mistake?
Gawain's voice suddenly filled the room.
Mordred! Wha killed my brothers?
Who indeed?
He rushed upon the crooked man, towering with passion.
Who but Sir Lancelot, my husky friend?
Liar! I must away to see!
He stumbled out of the room, still rushing in the same charge which had taken him towards his brother.
But Mordred, are you sure they are dead?
The top of Gareth's head was off,
he said with indifference.
And he had a surprised expression. Gaheris had no expression,
because his head was split in half.
The king was more puzzled than horrified. He said with wondering sorrow,
Lance could not have done it. He knew them. He loved them. They had no helmets on, so that he could recognize them. He knighted Gareth. He would never have done such a thing.
No, of course.
But you say he did.
I say he did.
It must have been a mistake.
It must have been a mistake.
What do you mean?
I mean that the pure and fearless knight of the lake, whom you have allowed to cuckold you and carry off your wife, amused himself before he left by murdering my two brothers, both unarmed, and both his loving friends.
Arthur sat down on the bench. The little page, coming back with the ordered drink, bowed himself double.
Your drink, sir.
Take it away.
Sir Lucan the butler says, sir, can he have some help to bring the wounded men in, sir? And is there any bandage linen?
Ask Sir Bedivere.
Yes, sir.
Page, he cried as the child went out.
Sir.
How many casualties?
They say 20 knights dead, sir. Sir Belliance, the Orgulous, Sir Segwarides, Sir Griflet, Sir Brandiles, Sir Aglovale, Sir Tor, Sir Gota, Sir Gillimer, Sir Reynold's three brothers, Sir Damas, Sir Priamus, Sir Kay the Stranger, Sir Dryant, Sir Lambigus, Sir Herminde, Sir Pertilope.
But Gareth and Gaheris?
I heard nothing of them, sir.
Blubbering and still running, the red, mountainous man was in the room once more. He was running to Arthur like a child. He was sobbing.
It is true! It is true! I found a man who saw it done! Poor Gaheris and our wee brother Gareth! He has killed them both, unarmed!
He fell on his knees. He buried his sand-white head in the old king's mantle. Chapter 9. On a bright winter day, 6 months later, Joyous Gard was invested. The sun shone at right angles to the north wind, leaving the east side of the furrows white with frost. Outside the castle, the starlings and green plover searched anxiously in the stiff grass. The deciduous trees stood up in skeleton, like maps of the veins or of the nervous system. The cow droppings, if you hit them, rang like wood. Everything had the colour of winter, the faded lichen green, like a green velvet cushion which has been left in the sun for years. The vein trees, like the cushion, had a nap on their trunks. The conifers had it all over their funeral draperies. The ice crackled in the puddles and on the jellied moat. Joyous Gard itself stood up, a beautiful picture in the powerless sunshine. Lancelot's castle was not forbidding. The old-fashioned keeps of Arthur's accession had given place to a gaiety of defence now difficult to imagine. You must not picture it like the ruined strongholds with mortar crumbling between the stones which you see today. It was plastered. They had put chrome in the plaster, so that it was faintly gold. Its slated turrets, conical in the French fashion, crowded from complicated battlements in 100 unexpected aspirations. There were little fantastic bridges, covered like the Bridge of Sighs, from this chapel to that tower. There were outside staircases going heaven knows where, perhaps to heaven. Chimneys suddenly soared out of machicolations. Real stained-glass windows, high up and out of danger, gleamed where once there had been blank walls. Bannerets, crucifixes, gargoyles, waterspouts, weathercocks, spires and belfries crowded the angled roofs. Roofs going this way and that, sometimes of red tile, sometimes of mossy stone, sometimes of slate. The place was a town, not a castle. It was light pastry, not the dour, unleavened bread of old Dunlothian. Round the joyful castle there was the camp of its besiegers. Kings, in those days, took their household tapestries with them on campaign, which was a measure of the kind of camps they had. The tents were red, green, checkered, striped. Some of them were of silk. In a maze of colour and guy ropes, of tent pegs and tall spears, of chess players and sutlers, of tapestried interiors and of gold plate, Arthur of England had sat down to starve his friend. Lancelot and Guinevere were standing by a log fire in the hall. Fires were no longer lit in the middle of the rooms, leaving the smoke to escape as best it could through lanterns. Here there was a proper fireplace, richly carved with the arms and supporters of Benwick, and half a tree smouldered in the grate. The ice outside had made the ground too slippery for horses, so it was a day of truce, though undeclared. Guinevere was saying,
"I can't think how you could have done it."
"Neither can I, Jenny. I don't even know that I did do it, except that everybody says so."
"Can't you remember anything?"
"I was excited, I suppose, and frightened about you. There was a press of people waving weapons, and knights trying to stop me. I had to cut my way through."
"It seems unlike you."
"You don't suppose I wanted to, do you?" he asked bitterly. "Gareth was fonder of me than he was of his brothers. I was almost his godfather. Oh, let's leave it, for God's sake."
"Never mind," she said. "I dare say he is better out of it, poor dear."
Lancelot kicked the log thoughtfully, one arm on the mantelpiece, looking into the ashy glow. "He had blue eyes." He stopped, considering them in the fire. "When he came to court, he would not name his parents. It was because he had to run away from home so as to come in the first place. There was a feud between his mother and Arthur, and the old woman hated him coming. But he couldn't keep away. He wanted the romance and the chivalry and the honour, so he ran away to us and wouldn't say who he was. He didn't ask to be knighted. It was enough for him to be at the great centre until he had proved his strength." He pushed a stray branch into place. "Kay took him to work in the kitchen and gave him a nickname, Pretty Hands. Kay was always a bully. And then... oh, it seems so long ago." In the silence, while they stood, each with an elbow on the mantel and a foot towards the fire, the weightless ash shuffled down. "I used to give him tips sometimes, to buy himself his little things. Beaumain, the kitchen page. He took to me for some reason. I knighted him with my own hands." He looked at his fingers in surprise, moving them as if he had not seen them before. "Then he fought the adventure of the Green Knight, and we found out what a champion he was." "Gentle Gareth," he said, almost in amazement. "I killed him with the same hands, too, because he refused to wear his armour against me. What horrible creatures humans are! If we see a flower as we walk through the fields, we lop off its head with a stick. That is how Gareth has gone." Guinevere took the guilty hand with distress.
"You couldn't help it."
"I could have helped it." He was in his customary religious misery. "It was my fault. You are right that it was unlike me. It was my fault, my grievous fault. It was because I laid about me in the press."
"You had to make the rescue."
"Yes, but I could have fought the armed knights only, instead of which I laid about me against the half-armed foot soldiers, who had no chance. I was cap a pike, and they were in queer bouillé, just leather and pikes. But I cut at them, and God punished us.
It was because I had forgotten my knighthood that God made me kill poor Gareth, and Gaheris too.
Lance, she said sharply,
now we are in this hellish misery, he went on, refusing to listen. Now I have got to fight against my own king who knighted me and taught me all I know. How can I fight him? How can I fight Gawain even? I have killed 3 of his brothers. How can I add to that? But Gawain will never let me off. He will never forgive now. I don't blame him. Arthur would forgive us, but Gawain won't let him. I've got to be besieged in this hole like a coward, when nobody wants to fight except Gawain, and then they come outside with their fanfares and sing, Traitor knight, come out to fight, ya, ya, ya.
It doesn't matter what they sing. It doesn't make you a coward because they sing it.
And my own men are beginning to think so too. Bor, Blamor, Bleoberis, Lionel, they're always asking me to go out and fight. And when I do go out, what happens?
So far as I can learn, she said, what happens is that you beat them, and then you let them off and beg them to go home. Everybody respects your kindness.
He hid his head in the crook of his elbow. Did you know what happened in the last battle?
Bor had a tilt with the king himself and knocked him down. He jumped off his horse and stood over Arthur with his sword drawn. I saw it happen and galloped like mad. Bor said, shall I make an end of this war? Not so hardy, I shouted, on pain of thy head. So we got Arthur back on his horse, and I begged him on my knees to go away. Arthur began to cry. His eyes filled with tears, and he stared at me and said nothing. He looks much older. He doesn't want to fight us, but it is Gawain. Gawain was once on our side, but I slew his brothers in my wickedness.
Forget your wickedness. It is Gawain's black temper and Mordred's cunning.
If it were just Gawain, he lamented, there would still be a hope of peace. He is decent inside himself. He is a good man. But Mordred is always there, hinting to him and making him miserable. And there is the whole hatred of Gael and Gaul, and this new order of Mordred's. I can't see the end.
The Queen suggested for the 100th time, would it be of any use if I were to go back to Arthur and put myself on his mercy?
We have offered it, and they have refused. It is no use going in the face of that. They would probably burn you after all.
She left the fireplace and drifted over to the great embrasure of the window. Outside, the siege works were spread below. Some tiny soldiers in the enemy camp were merrily playing fox and geese on a frozen pond. Their clear laughter came up, separated by distance from the tumbles which gave it rise.
All the time the war goes on, she said, and footmen who are not knights get killed. But nobody notices that.
All the time.
She observed without turning, I think I will go back, dear, and chance it. Even if I am burned, that would be better than having the trouble.
He followed her to the window.
Jenny, I would go with you if it were any use. We could go together, and let them cut our heads off, if there was any hope of stopping the war by that. But everybody has gone mad. Even if we did give ourselves up, Bor and Hector and the rest would carry on the feud, if we were killed. There are 100 extra feuds on foot, for those we killed in the marketplace and on the stairs, and for things through half a century of Arthur's past. Soon, I will not be able to hold them, even as it is. Hebes le Renoum, Villiers the Valiant, Eure of Hungary, they would begin revenging us, and everything would be worse. Eure is horribly grateful.
Civilization seems to have become insane, she said.
Yes, and it seems that we have made it so. Bor, Lionel, and Gawain wounded,
and everybody raving for blood. I have to sally out with my knights and rush about pretending to strike, and perhaps Arthur will be urged against me, or Gawain will come, and then I have to cover myself with the shield and defend myself, and I mustn't hit back. The men notice it, and say that by not exerting myself I am prolonging the war, which makes it worse for them. What they say is true. Of course it is true. But the alternative is to kill Arthur and Gawain, and how can I do that? If only Arthur would take you back and go away, it would be better than this. She might have flared up at such a tactless suggestion 20 years before. It was a measure of their autumn that now she was amused. Jenny, it is a terrible thing to say, but it is true.
Of course it is true.
We seem to be treating you like a dummy.
We are all dummies.
He leaned his head against the cold stone of the embrasure until she took his hand.
Don't think about it. Just stay in the castle and be patient. Perhaps God will look after us.
You said that once before.
Yes, a week before they caught us.
Even if God won't, he remarked bitterly, we could apply to the Pope.
The Pope?
He looked up. What do you mean?
Why, Lance, the thing you said. If the Pope was to send bulls to both sides, saying he would excommunicate us if we didn't come to terms, if we appealed for a papal ruling, Bohr and the others would have to accept it. Surely.
He looked at her closely as she chose the words.
He could appoint the Bishop of Rochester to administer the terms of peace.
But what terms? She had caught her idea, however, and was on fire with it.
Lance, we too would have to accept them, whatever they might be, even if they were to mean... Even if they were bad for us, they would mean peace for the people, and our knights would have no excuse for carrying on the feud, because they would have to obey the church.
He could find no words.
Well?
She turned to him with a face of composure and relief, the efficient and undramatic face which women achieve when they have nursing to do, or some other employment of efficiency. He did not know how to answer it.
We can send a messenger tomorrow, she said.
Jenny.
He could not bear it that she was allowing herself to be handed from one to another, no longer young, or that he was to lose her, or that he was not to lose her. Between men's lives and their love and his old totems, he was left with nothing but shame. This she saw, and helped him with it also. She kissed him tenderly. Outside, the daily chorus was beginning.
Traitor knight, come out to fight! Yeah, yeah, yeah!
There, she said, stroking his white hair. Don't listen to them. My Lancelot must stay in the castle. And there will be a happy ending.
Chapter 10.
So, His Holiness has made their peace for them, said Mordred savagely.
Aye.
They were in the justice room, Gawain and himself, waiting for the last stages of the negotiations. Both were in black, but with the strange difference that Mordred was resplendent in his, a sort of Hamlet, while Gawain looked more like the gravedigger. Mordred had begun dressing with this dramatic simplicity since the time when he had become a leader of the popular party. Their aims were some kind of nationalism, with Gaelic autonomy, and a massacre of the Jews as well, in revenge for a mythical saint called Hugh of Lincoln. There were already thousands spread over the country who carried his badge of a scarlet fist clenching a whip, and who called themselves thrashers. About the older man, who only wore the uniform to please his brother, there was a homespun blackness, the true despairing dark of morning.
"Just fancy," Mordred went on. "If it had not been for the Pope, we should never have had this beautiful procession, with everybody carrying olive branches and the innocent lovers dressed in white."
"It was a good procession."
Gawain's mind did not move easily along the paths of irony, so he accepted the sneer as a statement of fact.
"It was well stage-managed."
The older brother moved uncomfortably, as if to ease his position, but returned to the same one from which he had started. He said doubtfully, almost as if it were a question or an appeal,
"Lancelot says in his letters that he killed our Gareth by mistake. He says he didn't see him."
"It would be just like Lancelot to lay about him at unarmed men without looking to see who they were. He was always famous for that."
This time the irony was so heavy that even Gawain took it as it was.
"I ween it dinna seem likely."
"Likely? Of course it isn't. That was not Lancelot's line. He was the preux chevalier who always spared people, who never slew a person weaker than himself. That was the high road to Lancelot's popularity. Do you suppose he would have suddenly dropped this pose to begin killing unarmed men regardless?"
With a pathetic effort to be fair, Gawain said,
"There seems to be nay reason why he should have killed them."
"Reason? Was Gareth our brother? He killed him as a reprisal, out of revenge, because it was our family that had caught him with the Queen."
More carefully, he added,
"It was because Arthur is fond of you, and he was jealous of your influence. He planned it fair, to weaken the clan Orkney."
"He has weakened himself."
"Besides, he was jealous of Gareth. He was afraid that our brother would poach on his preserves. Our Gareth copied him, which did not suit the preux chevalier. You can't have two knights without reproach."
The justice room had been prepared for the final pageant. It looked barren with only two men in it. They were sitting in a curious way, one behind the other on the steps of the throne, which meant that they did not look each other in the face. Mordred looked at the back of Gawain's head, and Gawain at the floor. He said with a slight choke,
"Gareth was the best of us."
If he had turned round quickly, he might have been surprised at the intentness with which he was being watched. The younger face was at variance with the music of its voice. If you had looked closely, you might have noticed that Mordred's manner in the past 6 months had become stranger.
"Dear fellow," he said, "and to be killed by the very man who had his faith."
"It will teach me ne'er to trust the Southron."
Mordred altered the pronoun with an imperceptible emphasis.
"Yes, it will teach us."
The old tyrant swung round. He seized the white hand so as to press it, speaking with confusion.
"I was used to thinking it was Agravain's mischief. Agravain's and yours. I thought you were over-prejudiced against Sir Lancelot. I'm ashamed."
"Blood is thicker than water."
"It is that, Mordred. A body may clatter about ideals, about right and wrong and matters of that ilk, but in the end it comes to your ain folk. I mind when Gareth used to rob the priest's wee orchard by the cliff."
He tailed off lamely, till the thin man prompted him.
"His hair was almost white when he was a boy. It was so fair."
"Kay used to name him Pretty Hands."
"That was meant for an insult."
"Aye, but it was true. His hands were bonny."
"And now he is in his grave."
Gawain flushed to the eyebrows, the veins swelling at his temples.
"God's curse on them!"
I will not have this peace. I will not forgive them. Why should King Arthur seek to smooth it o'er? What business has the Pope within it? It is my brother that was butchered, none of theirs. And God Almighty, I will have the vengeance.
Lancelot will slip through our fingers. He is an oily man to hold.
He shall not slip. We hold him this time. The Cornwalls have forgiven overmuch.
Mordred shifted on the steps.
Have you ever thought what the table has done to Cornwall and Orkney? Arthur's father killed our grandfather. Arthur seduced our mother. And Lancelot has killed three of our brothers, besides Florence and Lovell. Yet here we are, selling our honour to reconcile the two Englishmen. It seems cowardly.
Nay, it is not cowardly. The Pope may force the king to take his queen, but there is nay word in his bulls about Sir Lancelot. We gave him sanctuary to bring the woman, and we will also let him go. But after that,
why should we let him escape us even now?
By cause he has safe conduct. Good sakes, man Mordred, we are knighted men.
We must not stoop to dirty weapons, even if our enemies do.
Aye, just. We will let the boar have law to run, and then pursue him to the death. Arthur is failing. He will do our will.
It is sad, said Sir Mordred, how the poor king seems to lose his grip since all this business started.
Aye, it is sad, but he kens the difference yet of right and wrong.
It is a change for him.
He mean to fail his powers.
You guess so quickly.
His sarcasms were as easy as teasing a blind man.
He canna have it every way. He never should have sided with that traitor at the start.
Nor married Gwen.
Aye, the fault lies with them. It is na we who sought the quarrel.
Indeed, it is not.
The king must stand for justice. Even if his holiness should make him take the woman to his bed, we have our right towards Sir Lancelot. Man, he has done strong treason when he took the queen, as well as when he slew our brothers.
We have every right.
The burly fellow took the other's hand again, the pale one in the horny sextons. He said with difficulty,
It would be woeful sore to be alone.
We had the same mother, Gawain.
Aye.
And she was Gareth's mother, too.
Here comes the king.
The pageant of reconciliation had reached its final stages. With trumpets blowing in the courtyard, the dignitaries of church and state began to filter up the stairs. The courtiers, bishops, heralds, pages, judges, and spectators were talking as they came. The cube of tapestry, an empty vase before, began to flower with them. It flowered with bald-faced ladies in headdresses which looked like crescents or cones or the astonishing coiffure worn by the Duchess in Alice in Wonderland, in bright bodices with their waists under their armpits, in long skirts and flowing sleeves, in Cameline de Tripoli or taffeta or rosette. The delicate creatures swam into their places with an aroma of myrrh and honey, with which they had washed their teeth. Their gallants, young squires in the height of fashion, many of them wearing Mordred's badge as thrashers, came mincing in with their long-toed shoes, in which it was impossible to walk upstairs. At the foot of the steps they had slipped out of them, and their pages had carried them up. The impression given by the young men was mainly of legs in stockings. It had even been found necessary to pass a sumptuary law, which insisted that their jackets should be long enough to cover the buttocks. Then there were more responsible councillors in extraordinary hats, some of which were like tea cosies, some turbans, some bird wings, some muffs. The gowns of these were pleated and padded, with high ruff-like collars, epaulettes, and jewelled belts. There were clerks with neat little skull caps to keep their tonsures warm, dressed in sober clothes which contrasted with the laity. There was a visiting cardinal in the glorious tasselled hat which still adorns the notepaper of Wolsey's College at Oxford. There were furs of every kind, including a handsome arrangement of black and white lamb's wool, sewed in contrasting diamonds. The talkers made a noise like starlings. This was the first part of the pageant. The second part began with nearer premonitions on the trumpets. Then came several Cistercians, secretaries, deacons, and other religious people, all burdened with ink made by boiling the bark of blackthorn, parchment, sand, bulls, pens, and the sort of penknife which scribes used to carry in their left hands when they were writing. They also had tally sticks and the minutes of the last meeting. The third instalment was the Bishop of Rochester, who had been appointed nuncio. He came in all the state of a nuncio, though he had left his canopy downstairs. He was a silk-haired senior, with his cope and crozier, alb and ring, urbane, ecclesiastical, knowing the spiritual power. Finally, the trumpets were at the door, and England came. In weighty ermine, which covered his shoulders and the left arm, with a narrower strip down the right, in the blue velvet cloak and overwhelming crown, heavy with majesty and supported, almost literally supported, by the proper officers, the king was led to the throne on the dais, its canopy golden with embroideries of the dragons ramping in red. And there, the crowd now parting, Gawain and Mordred were revealed to meet him. He sank down where he was put. The standing nuncio seated himself also on a throne opposite, hung with white and gold. The buzz subsided.
"We are ready to begin?"
Rochester's priestly voice relieved the tension.
"The church is ready."
"So is the state."
It was Gawain's rumble, faintly offensive.
"Is there anything which we ought to settle before they come?"
"It is all fair settled."
Rochester turned his eyes to the Laird of Orkney.
"We are obliged to Sir Gawain."
"Ye are welcome."
"In that case," said the king, "I suppose we must tell Sir Lancelot that the court is waiting to receive him."
"Bedivere, man. Send forth to bring the prisoners."
It was noticed that Gawain had put himself in the habit of speaking on the throne, and that Arthur let him do it. The nuncio, however, was less subdued.
"One moment, Sir Gawain. I have to point out that the church does not regard these people as prisoners. The mission of His Holiness, which I represent, is one of pacification, not of revenge."
"The church can I regard the prisoners as she pleases. We are for doing what the church has said, but we shall do it in our ain poor fashion. Bring forth the prisoners."
"Sir Gawain."
"Blow for her majesty. The court sits."
In the middle of music like a bad pageant, and of music answered from outside, the heads turned round to the doors. There was a rustle among the silks and furs. A lane was made with shuffling. In the archway now open, Lancelot and Guinevere waited for their cue. There was something pathetic about their grandeur, as if they were dressed up for a charade, but not quite fitted. They were in white cloth of gold tissue, and the queen, no longer young or lovely, carried her olive branch ungracefully. They came shyly down the lane, like well-meaning actors who were trying to do their best, but who were not good at acting. They kneeled in front of the throne.
"My most redoubted king."
The movement of sympathy was caught by Mordred.
"Charming!"
Lancelot looked to the elder brother.
"Sir Gawain."
Orkney showed him his back. He turned towards the church. My Lord of Rochester.
Welcome, my son.
I have brought Queen Guinevere by the king's command and by the Pope's.
There was an awkward silence in which nobody dared to help their speech along.
It is my duty, then, if nobody will answer, to affirm the Queen of England's innocence.
Liar!
I am come to maintain with my body that the Queen is fair, true, good, and clean to King Arthur, and this I will make good upon any challenge, excepting only if it were the King or Sir Gawain. It is my duty to the Queen to make this proffer.
The Holy Father bids us to accept your proffer, Lancelot.
The pathos which was growing in the room was broken by the Orkney faction for the second time.
Fie on his proud words, cried Gawain. As for the Queen, let her bide and be forgiven. But thou, false recreant knight, what cause hadst thou to slay my brother, that loved thee more than all my kin?
Both the great men had slipped into the high language, suitable to the place and passion.
God knows it helps me not to excuse myself, Sir Gawain. I would rather to have killed my nephew, Sir Bor, but I did not see them, Gawain, and I have paid it. It was done in despite of me and of Orkney.
It repents me to the heart, he said, that you should think so, my lord Gawain. For I know that while you are against me, I shall never more be accorded with the king.
True words, man Lancelot. He came under safe conduct and sanctuary to bring the queen, but ye shall go hence as the murderer ye are. If I am a murderer, God forgive me, my lord, but I never slew by treason.
He had intended his protest in innocence, but it was received at more than its face value. Gawain, clapping one hand to his dagger, cried,
I take your meaning in that. You mean Sir Lamorack.